Authentic is sponsored in whole by Voice of Prophecy.
Ever seen those cartoons where somebody's got like a devil on one shoulder and an angel on another? It's a cheesy way of describing what it's like to be tempted. So what does it mean, temptation? And really, what's so wrong about just giving in to it? And what if you're actually forced to choose between two really bad options? I'll be right back to start unpacking some of that on today's episode of Authentic.
Welcome to Authentic. Sean Boonstra explores real existential questions about the meaning of your life and how you can live a genuine human existence. Listen every week right here on this station or on your favorite podcatcher. Here's Sean with this week's episode of Authentic.
You probably remember this because it was so incredibly controversial, but back in the late 1980s, the American director Martin Scorsese released a film called The Temptation of Christ, based on a 1955 novel by the same name. And as you might expect, anytime you mess around with the biblical story of Jesus, it really upset a lot of people. In fact, one group of protesters in France actually set fire to a theater with people inside, which, if you ask me, is a really strange way to try and set the record straight when it comes to promoting the teachings of Christ. Martin Scorsese received multiple death threats, which again seems like an odd way to try and make the truth about Jesus seem more obvious. Now, to be perfectly honest, I've never seen the movie, even though I wasn't a practicing Christian when it first hit theaters. And in hindsight, I'm guessing that my Christian background probably kept me from wanting to see it, the same way that my current Christian practice has made the premise of the film seem, well, distasteful to me. Today, the teachings in the person of Christ are so important to me that I'm just not interested in wading around in the mud with somebody who was trying to twist the life of Christ into something that it wasn't. I mean, let's be honest. The actual narrative you find in the Bible is challenging enough without having to make stuff up. And I've always felt that altering the story is kind of pointless. Because if Jesus was real, and he really was the Son of God, all you could possibly hope to do by changing the story is to cheat yourself of something pretty incredible. I mean, think of it like this. Let's pretend you were dying of a terminal disease, and the doctors have an actual cure, but you choose to believe that drinking dandelion milk is a better solution. In a case like that, you're going to die because you wasted time on a lie instead of investigating the life-giving truth. Of course, if it's all just fiction, then what does a little movie matter? Believe what you want and waste your time contemplating whatever you want. But if this book is telling the truth, I would think it might be smarter to wrestle with a deeply challenging reality, a reality that has the potential to add meaning to your life. Now, that having been said, I will give the original author, and now I'm talking about the book and not the movie, I'll give the author a few points for bringing one important idea to the forefront. And that's the idea that sometimes we talk about Jesus as if he's completely unlike us. He got that part right. Not much else, but he got that right. I mean, when Jesus was tempted, it was real. It wasn't some kind of show trial. And that's really important to understand because Christians sometimes like to emphasize Christ's deity and talk about him as if he was completely different from every other human being who's ever lived. But the Bible is crystal clear that he lived an authentic human life. Like it says in this passage that I often quote from the book of Hebrews. "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens," the author tells us, "Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." So now we're about to tread on some really dangerous ground because trying to figure out exactly how divinity can blend with humanity so that Jesus can be fully God and fully man at the very same time? Well, that's really beyond even the brightest of minds, and you quickly get into trouble if you're not being careful. It seems like there are two equal but opposite ditches that you can fall into when you consider the nature of Christ. One, you can talk about Jesus like he's entirely like us, completely the same in every single detail, which can lead to ignoring his deity. Or two, you can talk about Jesus like he's completely not like us, which ignores the incarnation and the humanity of Christ. So anytime you touch on the nature of Christ, on the way that Jesus was fully God and fully human at the very same time, you run into the risk of very probably getting it wrong, at least if you find yourself trying to drill this down to the very finest details. And so I want to move forward with a great deal of caution today, because I don't want to find myself playing the part of a fool who rushes into places where angels fear to tread. It's a responsibility that I take very seriously, because while I'm naturally going to be wrong about all kinds of stuff all the time, I still do my level best to talk about what I know to be true and to stay away from things that are way above my pay grade. So, with that disclaimer firmly in place, I want to talk about the real story of the temptation of Christ, the way it reads in the Bible, because I think it says a lot about the way that you and I are required to navigate life. It's the story of a man who was completely unlike us because he was sinless, God in human flesh. But more importantly, it's also the story of a man who was like us, the way the book of Hebrews describes. He came to live an authentic human life and to show us what it means to live as the image of God. And we really have two choices when it comes to examining this story, because the Bible gives us two different versions, at least when it comes to the details. Mark only mentions the temptation of Christ in passing, but then you find one detailed account in Matthew and another one in Luke. Now, the content is the same. It's the same list of three temptations, but Matthew and Luke actually list them in a different order. Matthew arranges the temptation so they kind of build to a natural climax, and he ends with the devil offering to give Jesus all the kingdoms of this world. But then Luke's order is somewhat different. He lists the temptations differently, beginning with the temptation to turn stones into bread, then the offer of the kingdoms of this world, and then finally daring Jesus to leap from the pinnacle of the temple. Luke is roughly approximating the order of the temptations you find in the Garden of Eden, where the serpent starts with an appeal to human appetite and then leads to this idea that we can become something more than human, godlike. Of course, as I've mentioned in other episodes, Matthew is emphasizing the kingship of Jesus, demonstrating that Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And Luke is underlining the humanity of Christ by showing Jesus as the Son of Man. And I struggle a little bit to decide which version we should look at today, because there's a lot to learn from both approaches. But I think because Matthew is actually a bit of a personal favorite, I'm going to look at it from his perspective. Of course, what you should probably do when the show is over is go back and read both accounts to see what you can learn from these two different approaches. But now it's time to get down to brass tacks and do a little bit of reading. So here we go, beginning in Matthew 4 and verse 1. The Bible says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry." So let's pause there for a moment and consider the information we already have. The temptation of Christ, according to the Bible, was something that had to happen. So in other words, it was planned. It tells us the Spirit led Jesus into the wilderness specifically for the purpose of being tempted. You see, as you study the ministry of Jesus, what you're going to find is that there's just no end to the breadth of it. If you ask the question, what did Jesus come to do? You're not going to find an easy answer. I mean, yes, the book of Luke summarizes his ministry beautifully by saying the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. And that's really what he did in a nutshell. But unpacking that idea is going to take the rest of your life, and even then you won't be done. And right here at the top of the story, we discover that Jesus had to face the devil. He had to be tempted, and the Spirit of God arranged it. Why? Because you and I failed. Humanity failed. We believed a lie and we caved in the face of temptation. And if Jesus is going to stand as the new head of the human race, as an authentic human being made in the image of God, he's going to have to face the same challenges that we do. And I'll be right back after this to explore that just a little bit more.
Life can throw a lot at us. Sometimes we don't have all the answers. but that's where the Bible comes in. It's our guide to a more fulfilling life. Here at the Voice of Prophecy, we've created the Discover Bible Guides to be your guide to the Bible. They're designed to be simple, easy to use, and provide answers to many of life's toughest questions. And they're absolutely free. Sign up at BibleStudies.com today and start your journey of discovery.
Retirement planning can be a stressful process, but it doesn't have to be. The friendly people at the Voice of Prophecy can walk you through the entire process and explain all of your options based on your specific needs. Whether you'd like to set up a trust for income or make a gift that will benefit your loved ones and change lives through the Voice of Prophecy, we're here to help. To learn more, call 1-800-348-5993.
This is Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
The story of the real temptation of Christ begins by telling us that this was something that had to happen. And then it tells us that by the time the devil shows up, Jesus has already been fasting for 40 days. Now, it doesn't tell us exactly why he's fasting, but it's not too hard to figure it out. Right before this story, we find the story of Jesus' baptism, where a voice from heaven suddenly says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." He's been publicly introduced as Messiah, and the baptism is the point at which Jesus' public ministry begins. So what is he doing in the wilderness? He's probably contemplating the nature of his work, the task that lies before him, and he's probably fasting to keep his mind clear, which is a spiritual discipline that Christians have largely lost sight of here in the 21st century. And it's after 40 days of not eating that the devil suddenly shows up. It says in verse 3, "Now, when the tempter came to him, he said, 'If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread.'" There's an important word in that statement, and it's a really short word. It's that tiny word, "if." God the Father has just publicly declared that Jesus is his Son, and now the tempter is trying to make Jesus doubt that. And you'll notice he doesn't do it when Jesus is strong and brimming with confidence. The tempter hits him when he's fatigued. Now, I've never fasted for 40 days, but I've done it for 10. And I can tell you that there comes a point where you begin to feel, well, a little weak. So what we have here in essence is a person who's getting kicked while he's down. And that tells us something about the nature of temptation. It doesn't really happen when you're resolute and brave. It happens during moments of weakness, when you're tired, or you're angry, or maybe you're even bored. And it's at those moments that bad ideas quickly develop into temptation. Let me give you an example of what I'm getting at. On a normal day, when you're making a purchase at the 7-Eleven, you can look at those lottery tickets on the counter and know that your odds of winning are incredibly low. You know, one out of millions. So you have the presence of mind to think about your household budget, and you realize that dropping 50 bucks on lottery tickets is not the best use of your money. In fact, it's not much better than actually burning the cash. But now let's suppose that you've been fired, and your funds are low, and you don't have the money you need to make your mortgage payment on the first of the month. This morning, you saw that the jackpot is now at $1.3 billion. So your desperate need begins to drive your appetite in ways that it wouldn't otherwise. And of course, you tell yourself that if you had that kind of money, you'd be the most benevolent person on earth, and you think about all the good you would do. You would build a new clinic. You would open an orphanage in India. You would even give most of that money to the church. But of course, the odds are exactly the same as they were before, which is as close to zero as you can get without it actually being zero. But now, for some reason, when you don't actually have 50 bucks to spare, you're far more tempted to buy the tickets than when you do have the 50 bucks, because now you're being driven by desperation. Or maybe it's something far more serious than just spending a couple of bucks on a lottery ticket, which for most people is neither here nor there. Maybe you're tempted to go and rob a bank. It's something you would never do under any other circumstance. But now you're at risk of being thrown on the street, and your perception of reality is being skewed by your sense of desperation. I mean, don't most people judge criminals differently if we know they stole a loaf of bread because they were hungry? Everybody instinctively knows there's a difference between stealing because you're needy and stealing because you're greedy. The world's not going to judge you quite as harshly, and really, don't you need the money more than most people? Never mind that stealing actually transfers your problems to somebody else. And never mind the fact that people usually get hurt during a bank robbery or at least traumatized. In this case, we just tell ourselves the ends really do justify the means because we're in trouble. Now, what I'm not suggesting is that we shouldn't pay attention to someone's motives when we're considering punishment. I'm simply pointing out that desperation has a way of shifting our values, of making us consider things we would never consider under any other circumstance. What isn't a temptation when we're strong suddenly becomes one when we're weak. And that's what's happening to Jesus. He's been tempted after 40 days of fasting. "Hey," the devil says, "if you really are the Son of God, why don't you just turn these stones into bread? Easy peasy, no need to go hungry." It's the temptation of exception. Intellectually, you know it's wrong, but these are special circumstances, right? And most of us wouldn't hesitate to find an easy fix for hunger. And that's the way it always seems to go. We know that something is wrong, and of course we would never do it. But then we tell ourselves this is a special occasion. Just think about the number of times you've told somebody, "Look, I'm sorry I did that to you, but here's what you've got to understand." Understand what? That you actually had a good reason for behaving badly? Is that supposed to make the way you hurt somebody else now acceptable? Look, I understand there are special cases where you had to choose from the least among evils, like the famous conundrum that came from World War II. The Nazis are knocking at your door and they're demanding to know if you're hiding Jews. If you tell the truth, there's a good chance that innocent people are going to die. So you've got to make up your mind. Do you lie to save human lives? Or do you tell the truth and watch your house guests get herded into a cattle car and sent to a death camp? So yeah, in the real world, we often find ourselves up against some really hard choices. And sometimes we try to figure out not how to save the day, but how to cause the least harm. And I do think it might be a good idea to come back someday and re-examine that exact scenario, because I actually think there are good answers about how to navigate those kinds of ethics. But for right now, I just want to focus on the temptation we all experience. We like to convince ourselves that something might be wrong under most circumstances, but this circumstance is an exception. What we find the devil doing in this story is trying to convince Jesus to use his divine power to solve a human problem. But what Jesus came to do, at least in part, is to succeed where the first Adam failed. When the tempter first appealed to our appetite in Eden, it worked. We chose personal satisfaction over obedience to God. And in this story, precisely the opposite happens. Adam and Eve were not dying of hunger the day they were tempted. In fact, they lived in a world of plenty. But still the tempter appealed to their appetite and said, "Listen, maybe God said you couldn't eat from every tree, but have you actually looked at this one?" So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, it says in Genesis, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took its fruit and ate. Way back then, it wasn't a case of need. But most people would have no problem suggesting that Jesus might be perfectly justified in doing this because he's just been fasting for 40 days, and we all know that 41 days starts to get dangerous. I'll be right back after this.
Here at the Voice of Prophecy, we're committed to creating top quality programming for the whole family, like our audio adventure series, Discovery Mountain. Discovery Mountain is a Bible-based program for kids of all ages. Your whole family will enjoy the faith-building stories from this small mountain summer camp and town. With 24 seasonal episodes every year and fresh content every week, there's always a new adventure just on the horizon. Check it out today at discoverymountain.com.
This is Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
Back in the 1960s, when Joseph Fletcher released his now famous book, Situation Ethics, he argued that right and wrong are not necessarily clear-cut ethical categories, that the real world might be more a matter of shades of gray. Something might be wrong under most circumstances, he said, but sometimes it's perfectly justified because the situation demands it. There are times, Joseph Fletcher wrote, when a man has to push his principles aside and do the right thing. Now, I want to be careful because in a broken world, there actually are some gray areas, and not everything is always easy to figure out, ethically speaking. And I also want to be careful that I don't make a caricature out of this book, because while I disagree with his basic premise, the book is far more nuanced than I'm about to lead some of you to believe. I guess I just felt the need to mention him because he had such a profound influence on the way that our generation thinks. But now let's get back to the matter at hand, and that's the first temptation of Christ the way it reads in Matthew chapter 4. Somebody might be asking why it would be wrong for Jesus to feed himself, and the answer is, well, it wouldn't be. And that's kind of the point. The road to darkness never starts with an obvious evil. Of course Jesus is hungry, and of course it's not a sin to take care of your basic physical needs. That's not the point of the story. What the devil is suggesting is that Jesus should use his divine power for his own benefit. And he's also tempting him to defend himself. The heavens had parted, the voice of his Father had told the world that he was Messiah, the Son of God. And now, in a moment of physical weakness, another voice is saying, "If you are the Son of God." In other words, he's tempting Jesus, the man, to doubt something that God has plainly said, which is exactly what happened in Eden. "Do not eat from that tree," God said. But then the serpent whispered, "Did God really say that for real?" Which brings us to Jesus' answer, which you find in verse 4. "But he answered and said, 'It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God.'" Here's what's going on in this story: a balancing of two essential requirements, our physical needs and our need to be in harmony with our Maker. And if you have to prioritize one of those, if it comes down to choosing between those two, we need to choose our relationship with God. The human brain is remarkably good at finding reasons to disobey. We have this talent for manufacturing a reason that God must be wrong in this particular case, that he would change his mind if he only understood our circumstances. You and I are remarkably gifted when it comes to the art of justification. And the fallen heart almost always chooses self. Just a few chapters later, Jesus makes it obvious why he made the decision he did. Listen to what he says in the Sermon on the Mount. "Therefore do not worry, saying, 'What shall we eat?' Or 'What shall we drink?' Or 'What shall we wear?' For after all these things the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." Have a look at what we already know from this story. The temptations were something Jesus had to go through, and it says that the Spirit was the one who led him into the wilderness. This was an exercise in trust, which is one of the biggest things the human race lost when we turned our backs on God. We used to trust what he said. We used to believe that he always had our best interests at heart. We used to trust that he actually knew what he was talking about. And then we listened to a serpent and foolishly tossed our trust out the window. So as a real human being, Jesus the man was going to have to restore that trust between the Creator and his creation. He was going to have to endure real privation, real discomfort, and trust that obedience was still important. And so no, there's nothing wrong with eating when you're hungry, but there is something wrong with taking moral shortcuts when you know full well what you should be doing. Jesus had to conquer appetite in pursuit of obedience, because you and I rejected obedience for the sake of appetite. And if he was going to become the new head of the human race, he had to do this as one of us. If he'd caved into temptation, you and I would be lost. Our corporate rebellion, our corporate disobedience would stand on the books for all eternity, and there would be no justifiable way to restore us to the kingdom of God. What we have in the Bible is the story of a man who would not take shortcuts, who wouldn't take the easy road, not if it meant losing you. The final path to victory in this case included the cross. And if there was ever a reason to say, "You know, in this case, I'm just not going to do it," that would have been it. But that also would have been game over for all of us. I'll be right back after this.
Dragons, beasts, cryptic statues. If you've ever read Daniel or Revelation and come away scratching your head, you're not alone. Voice of Prophecy's free Focus on Prophecy guides are designed to help you unlock the prophetic mysteries of the Bible and deepen your understanding of God's plan for you and the world around you. You can study online or request them by mail. Visit BibleStudies.com and start bringing prophecy into focus today.
Welcome back. It's Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
So far, we've only explored one out of the three temptations. That means we're going to have to come back some other day. So maybe let's review some of the highlights so far. This is the story of a real man. He was God in human flesh, the divine Son of God. But he was also a real human being. And sometimes we forget that. I mean, yes, Jesus is larger than life, and he's very much unlike us in a lot of ways. But the point of this story is to show us that God understands what it's like to live in this place. When the Spirit led Jesus out into the wilderness, it wasn't a matter of just going through the motions. When the Bible says that Jesus was tempted, it means he was really tempted. And that's about the only part of the last temptation of Christ that the original author got right, the fact that Jesus was actually tempted. I've met a lot of Christians who tell me that Jesus couldn't have sinned in this story. And that doesn't really make sense, because then it's not a real temptation and he's not a real human being. And let's be honest about this. Jesus was tempted to do things that you and I will never be tempted to do, because changing stones into bread isn't exactly a part of our skill set. So in that sense, you might say that Jesus was tempted beyond what you and I go through. So yes, he could have sinned, or there wouldn't be a point to the story. But at the same time, I think it's important to point out that Jesus wouldn't have sinned because of his character. And there's no doubt that this story is designed to build your confidence in who he is. This is a God you can trust. You and me, we would have failed, but he didn't. Which only goes to show that you really can trust him with your future. Look, I know some people say that none of this ever actually happened, but that's an impression that quickly fades away if you make the effort to sit down and actually read this. And I mean, really pay attention to what's happening. This is the story of a world full of people you can't trust, and a God who goes to great lengths to prove that he's trustworthy. So maybe it's time to give this story one more look. Maybe it's time to examine God as he comes to this world in human flesh to live among us, really as one of us, and succeed in every area that we failed and then gave his life for us. Look, I've run out of time today, so I'm going to have to leave the other two temptations for another time. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Sean Boonstra, and this has been another episode of Authentic.
You've been listening to Authentic, sponsored by Voice of Prophecy. Remember, you can listen every week right here at the same time. And thank you. Authentic is funded by listeners just like you. You can support at voiceofprophecy.com. That's also where you can find all the episodes you missed, or where you can listen again. That's voiceofprophecy.com.